Wednesday, March 28, 1906. Orion Clemens's personality, his adventure at the house of Dr. Meredith, his 3 o'clock a.m. call on young lady, death of Mr. Clemens's father just after having been made county judge, Mr. Clemens's small income after having become bankrupt through maladministration of Charles L. Webster. My brother's experience was another conspicuous example of my scheme's efficiency. I will talk about that by and by. But for the moment, my interest suddenly centers itself upon his personality, moved thereto by this passing mention of him. And so I will drop other matters and sketch that personality. It is a very curious one. In all my 70 years, I have not met the twin of it. Orion Clemens was born in Jamestown, Fentress County, Tennessee, in 1825. He was the family's firstborn and antedated me 10 years. Between him and me came a sister, Margaret, who died aged 10 in 1837 in that village of Florida, Missouri, where I was born, and Pamela, mother of Samuel E. Moffat, who was an invalid all her life and died in the neighborhood of New York a year ago, aged about 75, after experimenting with every malady known to the human race and with every medicine and method of healing known to that race, and enjoying each malady in its turn and each medicine and each healing method, with an enthusiasm known only to persons with a passion for novelties. Her character was without blemish, and she was of a most kindly and gentle disposition. Also, there was a brother, Benjamin, who died in 1843, aged 10 or 12. Orion's boyhood was spent in that wee little log hamlet of Jamestown up there among the Knobs, so-called, of East Tennessee, among a very sparse population of primitives who were as ignorant of the outside world and as unconscious of it as were the other wild animals that inhabited the forest around. The family migrated to Florida, Missouri, then moved to Hannibal, Missouri, when Orion was 12 and a half years old. When he was 15 or 16, he was sent to St. Louis, and there he learned the printer's trade. One of his characteristics was eagerness. He woke with an eagerness about some matter or other every morning. It consumed him all day, it perished in the night, and he was on fire with a fresh new interest next morning before he could get his clothes on. He exploited in this way 365 red-hot new eagernesses every year of his life, until he died sitting at a table with a pen in his hand in the early morning, jotting down the conflagration for that day and preparing to enjoy the fire and smoke of it until night should extinguish it. He was then 72 years old. But I am forgetting another characteristic, a very pronounced one. That was his deep glooms, his despondencies, his despairs. These had their place in each and every day along with the eagernesses. Thus his day was mottled, from sunrise to midnight with alternating brilliant sunshine and black cloud. Every day he was the most joyous and hopeful man that ever was, I think, and also every day he was the most miserable man that ever was. While he was in his apprenticeship in St. Louis, he got well acquainted with Edward Bates, who was afterwards in Mr. Lincoln's first cabinet. Bates was a very fine man, an honorable and upright man, and a distinguished lawyer. He patiently allowed Orion to bring to him each new project. He discussed it with him and extinguished it by argument and irresistible logic, at first. But after a few weeks he found that this labor was not necessary, that he could leave the new project alone, and it would extinguish itself the same night. Orion thought he would like to become a lawyer. Mr. Bates encouraged him, and he studied law nearly a week, then, of course, laid it aside to try something new. He wanted to become an orator. Mr. Bates gave him lessons. Mr. Bates walked the floor reading from an English book aloud and rapidly turning the English into French, and he recommended this exercise to Orion. But as Orion knew no French, he took up that study and wrought at it like a volcano for 2 or 3 days, then gave it up. During his apprenticeship in St. Louis, he joined a number of churches, one after another, and taught in their Sunday schools, changing his Sunday school every time he changed his religion. He was correspondingly erratic in his politics, Whig today, Democrat next week, and anything fresh that he could find in the political market the week after. I may remark here that throughout his long life he was always trading religions and enjoying the change of scenery. I will also remark that his sincerity was never doubted. His truthfulness was never doubted. and in matters of business and money his honesty was never questioned. Notwithstanding his forever recurring caprices and changes, his principles were high, always high, and absolutely unshakable. He was the strangest compound that ever got mixed in a human mold. Such a person as that is given to acting upon impulse and without reflection. That was Orion's way. Everything he did with conviction and enthusiasm and with a vainglorious pride in the thing he was doing. And no matter what that thing was, whether good, bad, or indifferent, he repented of it every time in sackcloth and ashes before 24 hours had sped. Pessimists are born, not made. Optimists are born, not made. But I think he was the only person I have ever known in whom pessimism and optimism were lodged in exactly equal proportions. Except in the matter of grounded principle, he was as unstable as water. You could dash his spirits with a single word. You could raise them into the sky again with another one. You could break his heart with a word of disapproval. You could make him as happy as an angel with a word of approval. And there was no occasion to put any sense or any vestige of mentality of any kind into these miracles. Anything you might say would answer. He had another conspicuous characteristic, and it was the father of those which I have just spoken of. This was an intense lust for approval. He was so eager to be approved, so girlishly anxious to be approved by anybody and everybody without discrimination, that he was commonly ready to forsake his notions, opinions, and convictions at a moment's notice in order to get the approval of any person who disagreed with them. I wish to be understood as reserving his fundamental principles all the time. He never forsook those to please anybody. Born and reared among slaves and slaveholders, he was yet an abolitionist from his boyhood to his death. He was always truthful. He was always sincere. He was always honest and honorable. But in light matters, matters of small consequence, like religion and politics and such things, he never acquired a conviction that could survive a disapproving remark from a cat. He was always dreaming. He was a dreamer from birth, and this characteristic got him into trouble now and then. Once when he was 23 or 24 years old and was become a journeyman, he conceived the romantic idea of coming to Hannibal without giving us notice, in order that he might furnish to the family a pleasant surprise. If he had given notice, he would have been informed that we had changed our residence, and that that gruff old bass-voiced sailor man, Dr. Meredith, our family physician, was living in the house which we had formerly occupied, and that Orion's former room in that house was now occupied by Dr. Meredith's two ripe old maid sisters. Orion arrived at Hannibal per steamboat in the middle of the night and started with his customary eagerness on his excursion, his mind all on fire with his romantic project, and building and enjoying his surprise in advance. He was always enjoying things in advance. It was the make of him. He never could wait for the event, but must build it out of dream stuff and enjoy it beforehand. Consequently, sometimes when the event happened, he saw that it was not as good as the one he had invented in his imagination, and so he had lost profit by not keeping the imaginary one and letting the reality go. When he arrived at the house, he went around to the back door and slipped off his boots and crept upstairs and arrived at the room of those old maids without having wakened any sleepers. He undressed in the dark and got into bed and snuggled up against somebody. He was a little surprised, but not much, for he thought it was our brother Ben. It was winter and the bed was comfortable, and the supposed Ben added to the comfort, and so he was dropping off to sleep very well satisfied with his progress so far, and full of happy dreams of what was going to happen in the morning. But something else was going to happen sooner than that, and it happened now. The old maid that was being crowded squirmed and struggled and presently came to a half-waking condition and protested against the crowding. That voice paralyzed Orion. He couldn't move a limb. He couldn't get his breath. And the crowded one began to paw around, found Orion's new whiskers, and screamed, "Why, it's a man!" This removed the paralysis, and Orion was out of the bed and clawing around in the dark for his clothes in a fraction of a second. Both maids began to scream then, so Orion did not wait to get his whole wardrobe. He started with such parts of it as he could grab. He flew to the head of the stairs and started down, and was paralyzed again at that point, because he saw the faint yellow flame of a candle soaring up the stairs from below, and he judged that Dr. Meredith was behind it, and he was. He had no clothes on to speak of, but no matter, he was well enough fixed for an occasion like this, because he had a butcher knife in his hand. Orion shouted to him, and this saved his life, for the doctor recognized his voice. Then in those deep, sea-going bass tones of his that I used to admire so much when I was a little boy, he explained to Orion the change that had been made, told him where to find the Clemens family, and closed with some quite unnecessary advice about posting himself before he undertook another adventure like that. Advice which Orion probably never needed again as long as he lived. One bitter December night, Orion sat up reading until 3 o'clock in the morning, and then, without looking at a clock, sallied forth to call on a young lady. He hammered and hammered at the door, couldn't get any response, didn't understand it. Anybody else would have regarded that as an indication of some kind or other and would have drawn inferences and gone home. But Orion didn't draw inferences, he merely hammered and hammered. And finally the father of the girl appeared at the door in a dressing gown. He had a candle in his hand, and the dressing gown was all the clothing he had on, except an expression of unwelcome which was so thick and so large that it extended all down his front to his instep and nearly obliterated the dressing gown. But Orion didn't notice that this was an unpleasant expression. He merely walked in. The old gentleman took him into the parlor, set the candle on a table, and stood. Orion made the usual remarks about the weather and sat down and talked and talked and went on talking, that old man looking at him vindictively and waiting for his chance, waiting treacherously and malignantly for his chance. Orion had not asked for the young lady. It was not customary. It was understood that a young fellow came to see the girl of the house, not the founder of it. At last Orion got up and made some remark to the effect that probably the young lady was busy and he would go now and call again. That was the old man's chance, and he said with fervency, "Why, good God, aren't you going to stop to breakfast?" When my father died in 1847, the disaster happened, as is the customary way with such things, just at the very moment when our fortunes had changed and we were about to be comfortable once more, after several years of grinding poverty and privation which had been inflicted upon us by the dishonest act of one Ira Stout, to whom my father had lent several $1,000s, a fortune in those days and in that region. My father had just been elected county judge. This modest prosperity was not only quite sufficient for us and for our ambitions, but he was so esteemed, held in such high regard and honor throughout the county, that his occupancy of that dignified office would, in the opinion of everybody, be his possession as long as he might live. He went to Palmyra, the county seat, to be sworn in about the end of February. In returning home, horseback, 12 miles, a storm of sleet and rain assailed him, and he arrived at the house in a half-frozen condition. Pleurisy followed, and he died on the 24th of March. Thus our splendid new fortune was snatched from us, and we were in the depths of poverty again. It is the way such things are accustomed to happen. When I became a bankrupt through the ignorance and maladministration of Charles L. Webster, after having been robbed of $170,000 by James W. Page, inventor of a typesetting machine of a most ingenious and marvelous character, there is but one, it is in Cornell University, preserved as a curiosity, it is all of that. During the 7 immediately preceding years, we went to Europe in order to be able to live on what was left of our income, and it was sufficiently slender. During the succeeding 10 or 12 years, it was often as low as $12,000 a year, and at no time did it reach above $20,000 a year, I think. I am sure it did not reach above $12,000 until 2 years before we returned from Europe in October 1900. Then it improved considerably, but it was too late to be of much service to Mrs. Clemens. She had endured the economies of that long stretch of years without a single murmur, and now when fortune turned in our favor, it was too late. She was stricken down, and after 22 months of suffering, she died. In Florence, Italy, June 5, 1904. As I have said, the Clemens family was penniless. Orion came to the rescue. Thursday, March 29, 1906. Mr. Clemens as apprentice to Mr. Ament, Wilhelm II's dinner and potato incident, the printing of Reverend Alexander Campbell's sermon, incident of dropping watermelon on Henry's head, Orion buys Hannibal Journal, which is a failure, then he goes to Muscatine, Iowa, and marries, Mr. Clemens starts out alone to see the world, visits St. Louis, New York, Philadelphia, Washington, then goes to Muscatine and works in Orion's office, finds $50 bill, thinks of going to explore the Amazon and collect coca, gets Horace Bixby to train him as pilot, starts with Orion for Nevada when Orion is made secretary to Territory of Nevada. But I am in error. Orion did not come to Hannibal until 2 or 3 years after my father's death. He remained in St. Louis. Meantime, he was a journeyman printer and earning wages. Out of his wage, he supported my mother and my brother Henry, who was 2 years younger than I. My sister Pamela helped in this support by taking piano pupils. Thus we got along, but it was pretty hard sledding. I was not one of the burdens because I was taken from school at once upon my father's death and placed in the office of the Hannibal Courier as printer's apprentice, and Mr. Ament, the editor and proprietor of the paper, allowed me the usual emolument of the office of apprentice, that is to say board and clothes, but no money. The clothes consisted of 2 suits a year, but one of the suits always failed to materialize, and the other suit was not purchased so long as Mr. Ament's old clothes held out. I was only about half as big as Ament, consequently his shirts gave me the uncomfortable sense of living in a circus tent, and I had to turn up his pants to my ears to make them short enough. There were 2 other apprentices. One was Wales McCormick, 17 or 18 years old, and a giant. When he was in Ament's clothes, they fitted him as the candle mold fits the candle. Thus he was generally in a suffocated condition, particularly in the summertime. He was a reckless, hilarious, admirable creature. He had no principles and was delightful company. At first, we 3 apprentices had to feed in the kitchen with the old slave cook and her very handsome and bright and well-behaved young mulatto daughter. For his own amusement, for he was not generally laboring for other people's amusement, Wales was constantly and persistently and loudly and elaborately making love to that mulatto girl and distressing the life out of her and worrying the old mother to death. She would say, "Now, Marse Wales, can't you behave yourself?" With encouragement like that, Wales would naturally renew his intentions and emphasize them. It was killingly funny to Ralph and me. And to speak truly, the old mother's distress about it was merely a pretense. She quite well understood that by the customs of slaveholding communities, it was Wales's right to make love to that girl if he wanted to. But the girl's distress was very real. She had a refined nature, and she took all Wales's extravagant lovemaking in resentful earnest. We got but little variety in the way of food at that kitchen table, and there wasn't enough of it anyway. So we apprentices used to keep alive by arts of our own. That is to say, we crept into the cellar nearly every night by a private entrance which we had discovered, and we robbed the cellar of potatoes and onions and such things, and carried them downtown to the printing office where we slept on pallets on the floor, and cooked them at the stove and had very good times. Wales had a secret of cooking a potato which was noble and wonderful and all his own. Since his day, I have seen a potato cooked in that way only once. It was when Wilhelm II, Emperor of Germany, commanded my presence at a private feed toward the end of the year 1901. And when that potato appeared on the table, it surprised me out of my discretion and made me commit the unforgivable sin. Before I could get a grip on my discretion again, that is to say, I made a joyful exclamation of welcome over the potato, addressing my remark to the Emperor at my side without waiting for him to take the first innings. I think he honestly tried to pretend that he was not shocked and outraged, but he plainly was. And so were the other half-dozen grandees who were present. They were all petrified, and nobody could have said a word if he had tried. The ghastly silence endured for as much as 30 minutes, and would have lasted until now, of course, if the Emperor hadn't broken it himself. For no one else there would have ventured that. It was at 6:30 in the evening, and the frost did not get out of the atmosphere entirely until close upon midnight, when it did finally melt away, or wash away, under generous floods of beer. As I have indicated, Mr. Ament's economies were of a pretty close and rigid kind. By and by, when we apprentices were promoted from the basement to the ground floor and allowed to sit at the family table, along with the one journeyman, Pet McMurray, the economies continued. Mrs. Ament was a bride. She had attained to that distinction very recently, after waiting a good part of a lifetime for it, and she was the right woman in the right place, according to the Amentian idea, for she did not trust the sugar bowl to us, but sweetened our coffee herself. That is, she went through the motions. She didn't really sweeten it. She seemed to put 1 heaping teaspoonful of brown sugar into each cup, but according to Wales, that was a deceit. He said she dipped the spoon in the coffee first to make the sugar stick, and then scooped the sugar out of the bowl with the spoon upside down, so that the effect to the eye was a heaped-up spoon, whereas the sugar on it was nothing but a layer. This all seems perfectly true to me, and yet that thing would be so difficult to perform that I suppose it really didn't happen, but was one of Wales's lies. I have said that Wales was reckless, and he was. It was the recklessness of ever-bubbling and indestructible good spirits flowing from the joy of youth. I think there wasn't anything that that vast boy wouldn't have done to procure 5 minutes' entertainment for himself. One never knew where he would break out next. Among his shining characteristics was the most limitless and adorable irreverence. There didn't seem to be anything serious in life for him. There didn't seem to be anything that he revered. Once the celebrated founder of the, at that time, new and widespread sect called Campbellites arrived in our village from Kentucky, and it made a prodigious excitement. The farmers and their families drove or tramped into the village from miles around to get a sight of the illustrious Alexander Campbell and to have a chance to hear him preach. When he preached in a church, many had to be disappointed, for there was no church that would begin to hold all the applicants. So in order to accommodate all, he preached in the open air in the public square. And that was the first time in my life that I had realized what a mighty population this planet contains when you get them all together. He preached a sermon on one of these occasions, which he had written especially for that occasion. All the Campbellites wanted it printed so that they could save it and read it over and over again and get it by heart. So they drummed up $16, which was a large sum then, and for this great sum Mr. Ament contracted to print 500 copies of that sermon and put them in yellow paper covers. It was a 16-page duodecimo pamphlet, and it was a great event in our office. As we regarded it, it was a book, and it promoted us to the dignity of book printers. Moreover, no such mass of actual money as $16 in one bunch had ever entered that office on any previous occasion. People didn't pay for their paper and for their advertising in money. They paid in dry goods, sugar, coffee, hickory wood, oak wood, turnips, pumpkins, onions, watermelons. And it was very seldom indeed that a man paid in money, and when that happened, we thought there was something the matter with him. We set up the great book in pages, 8 pages to a form, and by help of a printer's manual, we managed to get the pages in their apparently crazy but really sane places on the imposing stone. We printed that form on a Thursday. Then we set up the remaining 8 pages, locked them into a form, and struck a proof. Wales read the proof and presently was aghast, for he had struck a snag. And it was a bad time to strike a snag because it was Saturday. It was approaching noon. Saturday afternoon was our holiday, and we wanted to get away and go fishing. At such a time as this, Wales struck that snag and showed us what had happened. He had left out a couple of words in a thin-spaced page of solid matter, and there wasn't another break line for 2 or 3 pages ahead. What in the world was to be done? Overrun all those pages in order to get in the 2 missing words? Apparently there was no other way. It would take an hour to do it. Then a revise must be sent to the great minister. We must wait for him to read the revise. If he encountered any errors, we must correct them. It looked as if we might lose half the afternoon before we could get away. Then Wales had one of his brilliant ideas. In the line in which the out had been made occurred the name Jesus Christ. Wales reduced that to J.C. It made room for the missing words, but it took 99% of the solemnity out of a particularly solemn sentence. We sent off the revise and waited. We were not intending to wait long. In the circumstances, we meant to get out and go fishing before that revise should get back, but we were not speedy enough. Presently, that great Alexander Campbell appeared at the far end of that 60-foot room, and his countenance cast a gloom over the whole place. He strode down to our end, and what he said was brief, but it was very stern, and it was to the point. He read Wales a lecture. He said, "So long as you live, don't you ever diminish the Savior's name again. Put it all in." He repeated this admonition a couple of times to emphasize it. Then he went away. In that day, the common swearers of the region had a way of their own of emphasizing the Savior's name when they were using it profanely. And this fact intruded itself into Wales's incorrigible mind. It offered him an opportunity for a momentary entertainment which seemed to him to be more precious and more valuable than even fishing and swimming could afford. So he imposed upon himself the long and weary and dreary task of overrunning all those 3 pages in order to improve upon his former work and incidentally and thoughtfully improve upon the great preacher's admonition. He enlarged the offending J.C. into Jesus H. Christ. Wales knew that that would make prodigious trouble, and it did, but it was not in him to resist it. He had to succumb to the law of his make. I don't remember what his punishment was, but he was not the person to care for that. He had already collected his dividend. It was during my first year's apprenticeship in the courier office that I did a thing which I have been trying to regret for 55 years. It was a summer afternoon, and just the kind of weather that a boy prizes for river excursions and other frolics, but I was a prisoner. The others were all gone holidaying. I was alone and sad. I had committed a crime of some sort, and this was the punishment. I must lose my holiday and spend the afternoon in solitude besides. I had the printing office all to myself there in the 3rd story. I had one comfort, and it was a generous one while it lasted. It was the half of a long and broad watermelon, fresh and red and ripe. I gouged it out with a knife, and I found accommodation for the whole of it in my person, though it did crowd me until the juice ran out of my ears. There remained then the shell, the hollow shell. It was big enough to do duty as a cradle. I didn't want to waste it, and I couldn't think of anything to do with it which could afford entertainment. I was sitting at the open window which looked out upon the sidewalk of the main street 3 stories below, when it occurred to me to drop it on somebody's head. I doubted the judiciousness of this, and I had some compunctions about it, too, because so much of the resulting entertainment would fall to my share and so little to the other person. But I thought I would chance it. I watched out of the window for the right person to come along, the safe person, but he didn't come. Every time there was a candidate, he or she turned out to be an unsafe one, and I had to restrain myself. But at last I saw the right one coming. It was my brother Henry. He was the best boy in the whole region. He never did harm to anybody. He never offended anybody. He was exasperatingly good. He had an overflowing abundance of goodness, but not enough to save him this time. I watched his approach with eager interest. He came strolling along, dreaming his pleasant summer dream, and not doubting but that Providence had him in his care. If he had known where I was, he would have had less confidence in that superstition. As he approached, his form became more and more foreshortened. When he was almost under me, he was so foreshortened that nothing of him was visible from my high place except the end of his nose and his alternately approaching feet. Then I poised the watermelon, calculated my distance, and let it go, hollow side down. The accuracy of that gunnery was beyond admiration. He had about 6 steps to make when I let that canoe go, and it was lovely to see those 2 bodies gradually closing in on each other. If he had had 7 steps to make, or 5 steps to make, my gunnery would have been a failure. But he had exactly the right number to make, and that shell smashed down right on the top of his head and drove him into the earth up to the chin. The chunks of that broken melon flew in every direction like a spray, and they broke 3rd-story windows all around. They had to get a jack, such as they hoist buildings with, to pull him out. I wanted to go down there and condole with him, but it would not have been safe. He would have suspected me at once. I expected him to suspect me anyway, but as he said nothing about this adventure for 2 or 3 days, I was watching him in the meantime in order to keep out of danger. I was deceived into believing that this time he didn't suspect me. It was a mistake. He was only waiting for a sure opportunity. Then he landed a cobblestone on the side of my head which raised a bump there so large I had to wear 2 hats for a time. I carried this crime to my mother, for I was always anxious to get Henry into trouble with her and could never succeed. I thought that I had a sure case this time when she should come to see that murderous bump. I showed it to her, but she said it was no matter. She didn't need to inquire into the circumstances. She knew I had deserved it, and the best way would be for me to accept it as a valuable lesson, and thereby get profit out of it. About 1849 or 1850, Orion severed his connection with the printing house in St. Louis and came up to Hannibal and bought a weekly paper called the Hannibal Journal, together with its plant and its goodwill, for the sum of $500 cash. He borrowed the cash at 10% interest from an old farmer named Johnson who lived 5 miles out of town. Then he reduced the subscription price of the paper from $2 to $1. He reduced the rates for advertising in about the same proportion, and thus he created one absolute and unassailable certainty, to wit, that the business would never pay him a single cent of profit. He took me out of the courier office and engaged my services in his own at $3.50 a week, which was an extravagant wage, but Orion was always generous, always liberal with everybody except himself. It cost him nothing in my case, for he never was able to pay me a penny as long as I was with him. By the end of the first year, he found he must make some economies. The office rent was cheap, but it was not cheap enough. He could not afford to pay rent of any kind. So he moved the whole plant into the house we lived in, and it cramped the dwelling place cruelly. He kept that paper alive during 4 years, but I have at this time no idea how he accomplished it. Toward the end of each year, he had to turn out and scrape and scratch for the $50 of interest due Mr. Johnson, and that $50 was about the only cash he ever received or paid out, I suppose, while he was proprietor of that newspaper, except for ink and printing paper. The paper was a dead failure. It had to be that from the start. Finally, he handed it over to Mr. Johnson and went up to Muscatine, Iowa, and acquired a small interest in a weekly newspaper there. It was not a sort of property to marry on, but no matter. He came across a winning and pretty girl who lived in Quincy, Illinois, a few miles below Keokuk, and they became engaged. He was always falling in love with girls, but by some accident or other he had never gone so far as engagement before. And now he achieved nothing but misfortune by it, because he straightway fell in love with a Keokuk girl. At least he imagined that he was in love with her, whereas I think she did the imagining for him. The first thing he knew, he was engaged to her, and he was in a great quandary. He didn't know whether to marry the Keokuk one or the Quincy one, or whether to try to marry both of them and suit everyone concerned. But the Keokuk girl soon settled that for him. She was a master spirit, and she ordered him to write the Quincy girl and break off that match, which he did. Then he married the Keokuk girl, and they began a struggle for life which turned out to be a difficult enterprise and very unpromising. To gain a living in Muscatine was plainly impossible, so Orion and his new wife went to Keokuk to live, for she wanted to be near her relatives. He bought a little bit of a job printing plant, on credit, of course, and at once put prices down to where not even the apprentices could get a living out of it, and this sort of thing went on. I had not joined the Muscatine migration. Just before that happened, which I think was in 1853, I disappeared one night and fled to St. Louis. There I worked in the composing room of the Evening News for a time, and then I started on my travels to see the world. The world was New York City, and there was a little World's Fair there. It had just been opened where the great reservoir afterward was, and where the sumptuous public library is now being built, Fifth Avenue and 42nd Street. I arrived in New York with $2 or $3 in pocket change and a $10 bank bill concealed in the lining of my coat. I got work at villainous wages in the establishment of John A. Gray and Green in Cliff Street, and I found board in a sufficiently villainous mechanics boarding house in Duane Street. The firm paid my wages in wildcat money at its face value, and my week's wage merely sufficed to pay board and lodging. By and by I went to Philadelphia and worked there some months as a sub on the Inquirer and the Public Ledger. Finally, I made a flying trip to Washington to see the sights there, and in 1854 I went back to the Mississippi Valley, sitting upright in the smoking car 2 or 3 days and nights. When I reached St. Louis, I was exhausted. I went to bed on board a steamboat that was bound for Muscatine. I fell asleep at once with my clothes on and didn't wake again for 36 hours. I worked in that little job office in Keokuk as much as 2 years, I should say, without ever collecting a cent of wages, for Orion was never able to pay anything. But Dick Higgum and I had good times. I don't know what Dick got, but it was probably only uncashable promises. One day in the midwinter of 1856 or 1857, I think it was 1856, I was coming along the main street of Keokuk in the middle of the forenoon. It was bitter weather, so bitter that that street was deserted almost. A light dry snow was blowing here and there on the ground and on the pavement, swirling this way and that way and making all sorts of beautiful figures, but very chilly to look at. The wind blew a piece of paper past me and it lodged against the wall of a house. Something about the look of it attracted my attention and I gathered it in. It was a $50 bill, the only one I had ever seen, and the largest assemblage of money I had ever encountered in one spot. I advertised it in the papers and suffered more than $1,000 worth of solicitude and fear and distress during the next few days, lest the owner should see the advertisement and come and take my fortune away. As many as 4 days went by without an applicant. Then I could endure this kind of misery no longer. I felt sure that another 4 could not go by in this safe and secure way. I felt that I must take that money out of danger. So I bought a ticket for Cincinnati and went to that city. I worked there several months in the printing office of Wrightson & Company. I'd been reading Lieutenant Herndon's account of his explorations of the Amazon and had been mightily attracted by what he said of coca. I made up my mind that I would go to the headwaters of the Amazon and collect coca and trade in it and make a fortune. I left for New Orleans in the steamer Paul Jones with this great idea filling my mind. One of the pilots of that boat was Horace Bixby. Little by little I got acquainted with him, and pretty soon I was doing a lot of steering for him in his daylight watches. When I got to New Orleans, I inquired about ships leaving for Para, and discovered that there weren't any, and learned that there probably wouldn't be any during that century. It had not occurred to me to inquire about these particulars before leaving Cincinnati, so there I was. I couldn't get to the Amazon. I had no friends in New Orleans and no money to speak of. I went to Horace Bixby and asked him to make a pilot out of me. He said he would do it for $100 cash in advance. So I steered for him up to St. Louis, borrowed the money from my brother-in-law, and closed the bargain. I had acquired this brother-in-law several years before. This was Mr. William A. Moffat, a merchant, a Virginian, a fine man in every way. He had married my sister Pamela, and the Samuel E. Moffat of whom I have been speaking was their son. Within 18 months I became a competent pilot, and I served that office until the Mississippi River traffic was brought to a standstill by the breaking out of the Civil War. Meantime, Orion had been sweating along with his little job printing office in Keokuk, and he and his wife were living with his wife's family, ostensibly as boarders, but it is not likely that Orion was ever able to pay the board. On account of charging next to nothing for the work done in his job office, he had almost nothing to do there. He was never able to get it through his head that work done on a profitless basis deteriorates and is presently not worth anything, and that customers are then obliged to go where they can get better work, even if they must pay better prices for it. He had plenty of time, and he took up Blackston again. He also put up a sign which offered his services to the public as a lawyer. He never got a case, in those days, nor even an applicant, though he was quite willing to transact law business for nothing and furnish the stationery himself. He was always liberal that way. Presently he moved to a wee little hamlet called Alexandria, 2 or 3 miles down the river, and he put up that sign there. He got no bites. He was by this time very hard aground, but by this time I was beginning to earn a wage of $250 a month as pilot, and so I supported him thenceforth until 1861, when his ancient friend Edward Bates, then a member of Mr. Lincoln's first cabinet, got him the place of Secretary of the new Territory of Nevada, and Orion and I cleared for that country in the Overland Stagecoach, I paying the fares, which were pretty heavy, and carrying with me what money I had been able to save. This was $800, I should say, and it was all in silver coin and a good deal of a nuisance because of its weight. And we had another nuisance, which was an unabridged dictionary. It weighed about 1,000 pounds and was a ruinous expense, because the stagecoach company charged for extra baggage by the ounce. We could have kept a family for a time on what that dictionary cost in the way of extra freight. And it wasn't a good dictionary anyway. Didn't have any modern words in it, only had obsolete ones that they used to use when Noah Webster was a child. Friday, March 30th, 1906. Mr. Clemens's interview with Tchaikovsky and Mr. Clemens's views regarding the Russian Revolution. Mr. Clemens presides at meeting of the association formed in interest of the adult blind, his first meeting with Helen Keller, Helen Keller's letter which Mr. Clemens read at this meeting. I will drop Orion for the present and return and pick him up by and by. For the moment I am more interested in the matters of today than I am in Orion's adventures and mine of 45 years ago. 3 days ago, a neighbor brought the celebrated Russian revolutionist, Tchaikovsky, to call upon me. He is grizzled and shows age, as to exteriors, but he has a Vesuvius inside, which is a strong and active volcano yet. He is so full of belief in the ultimate and almost immediate triumph of the revolution and the destruction of the fiendish autocracy that he almost made me believe and hope with him. He has come over here expecting to arouse a conflagration of noble sympathy in our vast nation of 80 millions of happy and enthusiastic freemen. But honesty obliged me to pour some cold water down his crater. I told him what I believed to be true, that the McKinleys and the Roosevelts and the multimillionaire disciples of Jay Gould, that man who in his brief life rotted the commercial morals of this nation and left them stinking when he died, have quite completely transformed our people from a nation with pretty high and respectable ideals to just the opposite of that. That our people have no ideals now that are worthy of consideration, that our Christianity, which we have always been so proud of, not to say so vain of, is now nothing but a shell, a sham, a hypocrisy, that we have lost our ancient sympathy with oppressed peoples struggling for life and liberty, that when we are not coldly indifferent to such things, we sneer at them, and that the sneer is about the only expression the newspapers and the nation deal in with regard to such things, that his mass meetings would not be attended by people entitled to call themselves representative Americans, even if they may call themselves Americans at all, that his audiences will be composed of foreigners who have suffered so recently that they have not yet had time to become Americanized and their hearts turned to stone in their breasts, that these audiences will be drawn from the ranks of the poor, not those of the rich, that they will give and give freely, but they will give from their poverty, and the money result will not be large. I said that when our windy and flamboyant president conceived the idea, a year ago, of advertising himself to the world as the new angel of peace, and set himself the task of bringing about the peace between Russia and Japan, and had the misfortune to accomplish his misbegotten purpose, no one in all this nation except Dr. Seaman and myself uttered a public protest against this folly of follies. That at that time I believed that that fatal peace had postponed the Russian nation's imminent liberation from its age-long chains indefinitely, probably for centuries. That I believed at that time that Roosevelt had given the Russian Revolution its death blow, and that I am of that opinion yet. I will mention here in parenthesis that I came across Dr. Seaman last night for the first time in my life and found that his opinion also remains today as he expressed it at the time that that infamous peace was consummated. Tchaikovsky said that my talk depressed him profoundly and that he hoped I was wrong. I said I hoped the same. He said, "Why, from this very nation of yours came a mighty contribution only 2 or 3 months ago, and it made us all glad in Russia. You raised $2 millions in a breath, in a moment, as it were, and sent that contribution, that most noble and generous contribution, to suffering Russia. Does not that modify your opinion?" "No," I said, "it doesn't. That money came not from Americans, it came from Jews, much of it from rich Jews, but the most of it from Russian and Polish Jews on the East Side. That is to say, it came from the very poor. The Jew has always been benevolent. Suffering can always move a Jew's heart and tax his pocket to the limit. He will be at your mass meetings, but if you find any Americans there, put them in a glass case and exhibit them. It will be worth 50 cents a head to go and look at that show and try to believe in it." He asked me to come to last night's meeting and speak, but I had another engagement and could not do it. Then he asked me to write a line or two which could be read at the meeting, and I did that cheerfully. New York Times, Arms to Free Russia, Tchaikovsky's Appeal. Revolutionist speaks to cheering audience of 3,000. Says the battle is near. Mark Twain writes that he hopes czars and grand dukes will soon become scarce. Tovarishzhi. When Nicholas Tchaikovsky, hailed by his countrymen here as the father of the revolutionary movement in Russia, spoke this word last night in Grand Central Palace, 3,000 men and women rose to their feet, waved their hats, and cheered madly for 3 minutes. The word means comrades. It is the watchword of the revolutionists. The spirit of revolution possessed the mass meeting called to greet the Russian patriot now visiting New York. Fight is what he wants, and arms to fight with. He told the audience so last night, and by their cheers they promised to do their part in supplying the sinews of war. Mark Twain could not attend because he had already accepted an invitation to another meeting, but he sent this letter. "Dear Mr. Tchaikovsky, I thank you for the honor of the invitation, but I am not able to accept it. because Thursday evening I shall be presiding at a meeting whose object is to find remunerative work for certain classes of our blind who would gladly support themselves if they had the opportunity. My sympathies are with the Russian Revolution, of course. It goes without saying I hope it will succeed, and now that I have talked with you, I take heart to believe it will. Government by falsified promises, by lies, by treachery, and by the butcher knife, for the aggrandizement of a single family of drones and its idle and vicious kin, has been borne quite long enough in Russia, I should think. And it is to be hoped that the roused nation, now rising in its strength, will presently put an end to it and set up the republic in its place. Some of us, even the white-headed, may live to see the blessed day when czars and grand dukes will be as scarce there as I trust they are in heaven. Most sincerely yours, Mark Twain. Mr. Tchaikovsky made an impassioned appeal for help to inaugurate a real revolution and overturn the czar and all his allies. The prior engagement which I spoke of to Tchaikovsky was an engagement to act as chairman at the first meeting of the association which was formed 5 months ago in the interest of the adult blind. Joseph H. Choate and I had a very good time there, and I came away with the conviction that that excellent enterprise is going to flourish and will bear abundant fruit. It will do for the adult blind what Congress and the several legislatures do so faithfully and with such enthusiasm for our lawless railway corporations, our rotten beef trusts, our vast robber dens of insurance magnates. In a word, for each and all of our multimillionaires and their industries, protect them, take watchful care of them, preserve them from harm like a providence, and secure their prosperity and increase it. The state of New York contains 6,000 listed blind persons and also 1,000 or so who have not been searched out and listed. There are between 300 and 400 blind children. The state confines its benevolence to these. It confers upon them a book education. It teaches them to read and write. It feeds them and shelters them. And, of course, it pauperizes them because it furnishes them no way of earning a living for themselves. The state's conduct toward the adult blind, and this conduct is imitated by the legislatures of most of the other states, is purely infamous. Outside of the blind asylums, the adult blind person has a hard time. He lives merely by the charity of the compassionate, when he has no relatives able to support him, and now and then, as a benevolence, the state stretches out its charitable hand and lifts him over to Blackwell's Island and submerges him among that multitudinous population of thieves and prostitutes. But in Massachusetts, in Pennsylvania, and in 2 or 3 other states, associations like this new one we have formed have been at work for some years, supported entirely by private subscriptions, and the benefits conferred and the work accomplished are so fine and great that their official reports read like a fairy tale. It seems almost proven that there are not so very many things accomplishable by persons gifted with sight, which a blind person cannot learn to do and do as well as that other person. Helen Keller was to have been present last night, but she is ill in bed, and has been ill in bed during several weeks, through overwork in the interest of the blind, the deaf, and the dumb. I need not go into any particulars about Helen Keller. She is fellow to Caesar, Alexander, Napoleon, Homer, Shakespeare, and the rest of the immortals. She will be as famous 1,000 years from now as she is today. I remember the first time I ever had the privilege of seeing her. She was 14 years old then. She was to be at Lawrence Hutton's house on a Sunday afternoon, and 12 or 15 men and women had been invited to come and see her. Henry Rogers and I went together. The company had all assembled and had been waiting a while. The wonderful child arrived now, with her about equally wonderful teacher, Miss Sullivan. The girl began to deliver happy ejaculations in her broken speech. Without touching anything, and without seeing anything, of course, and without hearing anything, she seemed to quite well recognize the character of her surroundings. She said, "Oh, the books, so many, many books. How lovely!" The guests were brought one after another and introduced to her. As she shook hands with each, she took her hand away and laid her fingers lightly against Miss Sullivan's lips, who spoke against them the person's name. When a name was difficult, Miss Sullivan not only spoke it against Helen's fingers, but spelled it out upon Helen's hand with her own fingers, stenographically, apparently, for the swiftness of the operation was suggestive of that. Mr. Howells seated himself by Helen on the sofa, and she put her fingers against his lips, and he told her a story of considerable length. And you could see each detail of it pass into her mind and strike fire there and throw the flash of it into her face. Then I told her a long story, which she interrupted all along and in the right places with cackles, chuckles, and carefree bursts of laughter. Then Miss Sullivan put one of Helen's hands against her lips and spoke against it the question, "What is Mr. Clemens distinguished for?" Helen answered in her crippled speech, "For his humor." I spoke up modestly and said, "And for his wisdom." Helen said the same words instantly, "And for his wisdom." I suppose it was a case of mental telegraphy, since there was no way for her to know what it was I had said. After a couple of hours, spent very pleasantly, someone asked if Helen would remember the feel of the hands of the company after this considerable interval of time, and be able to discriminate the hands and name the possessors of them. Miss Sullivan said, "Oh, she will have no difficulty about that." So the company filed past, shook hands in turn, and with each handshake, Helen greeted the owner of the hand pleasantly and spoke the name that belonged to it without hesitation, until she encountered Mr. Rogers toward the end of the procession. She shook hands with him, then paused, and a reflecting expression came into her face. Then she said, "I am glad to meet you now. I have not met you before." Miss Sullivan told her she was mistaken. This gentleman was introduced to her when she first arrived in the room, but Helen was not affected by that. She said no, she never had met this gentleman before. Then Mr. Rogers said that perhaps the confusion might be explained by the fact that he had his glove on when he was introduced to Helen. Of course, that explained the matter. This was not in the afternoon, as I have misstated. It was in the forenoon, and by and by the assemblage proceeded to the dining room and sat down to the luncheon. I had to go away before it was over, and as I passed by Helen, I patted her lightly on the head and passed on. Miss Sullivan called to me and said, "Stop, Mr. Clemens. Helen is distressed because she did not recognize your hand. Won't you come back and do that again?" I went back and patted her lightly on the head, and she said at once, "Oh, it's Mr. Clemens." Perhaps someone can explain this miracle, but I have never been able to do it. Could she feel the wrinkles in my hand through her hair? Someone else must answer this. I am not competent. As I have said, Helen was not able to leave her sickbed, but she wrote a letter 2 or 3 days ago to be read at the meeting, and Miss Holt, the secretary, sent it to me by a messenger at mid-afternoon yesterday. It was lucky for me that she didn't reserve it and send it to me on the platform last night, for in that case I could not have gotten through with it. I read it to the House without a break in my voice, and also without even a tremor in it that could be noticed, I think. But it was because I had read it aloud to Miss Lyon at mid-afternoon, and I knew the dangerous places and how to be prepared for them. I told the House in the beginning that I had this letter and that I would read it at the end of the evening's activities. By and by, when the end had arrived and Mr. Choate had spoken, I introduced the letter with a few words. I said that if I knew anything about literature, here was a fine and great and noble sample of it, that this letter was simple, direct, unadorned, unaffected, unpretentious, and was moving and beautiful and eloquent, that no fellow to it had ever issued from any girl's lips since Joan of Arc, that immortal child of 17, stood alone and friendless in her chains 5 centuries ago and confronted her judges, the concentrated learning and intellect of France, and fenced with them week by week and day by day, answering them out of her great heart and her untaught but marvelous mind, and always defeating them, always camping on the field and master of it as each day's sun went down. I said I believed that this letter, written by a young woman who has been stone deaf, dumb, and blind ever since she was 18 months old, and who is one of the most widely and thoroughly educated women in the world, would pass into our literature as a classic and remain so. I will insert the letter here. Wrentham, Mass., March 27, 1906. My dear Mr. Clemens, it is a great disappointment to me not to be with you and the other friends who have joined their strength to uplift the blind. The meeting in New York will be the greatest occasion in the movement which has so long engaged my heart, and I regret keenly not to be present and feel the inspiration of living contact with such an assembly of wit, wisdom, and philanthropy. I should be happy if I could have spelled into my hand the words as they fall from your lips, and receive, even as it is uttered, the eloquence of our newest ambassador to the blind. We have not had such advocates before. My disappointment is softened by the thought that never at any meeting was the right word so sure to be spoken. But superfluous as all other appeal must seem after you and Mr. Choate have spoken, nevertheless, as I am a woman, I cannot be silent, and I ask you to read this letter, knowing that it will be lifted to eloquence by your kindly voice. To know what the blind man needs, you who can see must imagine what it would be not to see, and you can imagine it more vividly if you remember that before your journey's end you may have to go the dark way yourself. Try to realize what blindness means to those whose joyous activity is stricken to inaction. It is to live long, long days, and life is made up of days. It is to live immured, baffled, impotent, all God's world shut out. It is to sit helpless, defrauded, while your spirit strains and tugs at its fetters, and your shoulders ache for the burden they are denied, the rightful burden of labor. The seeing man goes about his business confident and self-dependent. He does his share of the work of the world in mine, in quarry, in factory, in counting room, asking of others no boon, save the opportunity to do a man's part and to receive the labor's guerdon. In an instant, accident blinds him. The day is blotted out. Night envelops all the visible world. The feet which once bore him to his task with firm and confident stride stumble and halt and fear the forward step. He is forced to a new habit of idleness, which like a canker consumes the mind and destroys its beautiful faculties. Memory confronts him with his lighted past. Amid the tangible ruins of his life as it promised to be, he gropes his pitiful way. You have met him on your busy thoroughfares with faltering feet and outstretched hands, patiently dredging the universal dark, holding out for sale his petty wares or his cap for your pennies. And this was a man with ambitions and capabilities. It is because we know that these ambitions and capabilities can be fulfilled that we are working to improve the condition of the adult blind. You cannot bring back the light to the vacant eyes, but you can give a helping hand to the sightless along their dark pilgrimage. You can teach them new skill. For work they once did with the aid of their eyes, you can substitute work that they can do with their hands. They ask only opportunity, and opportunity is a torch in darkness. They crave no charity, no pension, but the satisfaction that comes from lucrative toil, and this satisfaction is the right of every human being. At your meeting, New York will speak its word for the blind, and when New York speaks, the world listens. The true message of New York is not the commercial ticking of busy telegraphs, but the mightier utterances of such gatherings as yours. Of late, our periodicals have been filled with depressing revelations of great social evils. Querulous critics have pointed to every flaw in our civil structure. We have listened long enough to the pessimists. You once told me you were a pessimist, Mr. Clemens, but great men are usually mistaken about themselves. You are an optimist. If you were not, you would not preside at the meeting, for it is an answer to pessimism. It proclaims that the heart and the wisdom of a great city are devoted to the good of mankind, that in this, the busiest city in the world, no cry of distress goes up, but receives a compassionate and generous answer. Rejoice that the cause of the blind has been heard in New York, for the day after, it shall be heard round the world. Yours sincerely, Helen Keller. This concludes the reading of Autobiography of Mark Twain